Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents V-Bombers, Britain's Nuclear Frontline in the Cold War, by Dr. Tony Redding. Narrated by Michael Langan. Author's note. Following the Nassau meeting between President Kennedy and Prime Minister Macmillan in 1962, the cancellation of the Skybolt air-launched missile and the offer of the submarine-launched Polaris promised the British a modern deterrent based on long-range ballistic missiles carried by a near-invulnerable launch platform. This outcome was ideal from the British standpoint. The UK would be freed from reliance on a small group of subsonic bombers, armed with inadequate weapons and uncomfortably exposed to destruction on the ground and in the air. The submarine-launched ballistic missile was, and for the moment is, the near-perfect small nation deterrent, but the problem was the inevitable wait. It would be at least 6 years before British Polaris submarines would begin their lone patrols. What could be done over this period to stretch the capability and credibility of the V-bombers, to bridge the gap in a world already dominated by intercontinental missiles? The scope of this book includes a detailed review of the efforts made to bridge this gap until Britain's strategic nuclear front line passed the submarines in mid-1969. It is also about much more: the dedicated aircrew and ground personnel, the aircraft, equipment and weapons, and, of course, the V-bombers' long period of supplementary nuclear service alongside the submarines, a period ending, perhaps ironically, in the Black Buck raids of the Falklands War in 1982. Given the main theme of this book, the latter campaign receives only passing reference, and the listener is directed to the excellent existing books dealing with this subject. In itself, a celebration of the continued capacity of Britain's armed services to make much out of very little. Returning to the V-Force strategic nuclear role, I have long puzzled over why the extensive literature concerning the Valiants, Victors, and Vulcans, the Cold War, the British bomb, the Anglo-American nuclear relationship, etc., contains no detailed account of V-Force capability and credibility, and no assessment of its operational capacity, had the Cold War turned hot. This is a significant gap in the literature, given that the V-Force was the cutting edge of UK military posture and international political presence in the very dangerous world of the 1960s and beyond. I hope this book goes some way towards placing on record the immense efforts made to keep us safe during the Cold War years. Dr. Tony Redding, Ashe, Canterbury, UK, 2023. Introduction. It cannot be right to acquiesce uncritically for the rest of human history in a system that maintains peace between potential adversaries partly by the threat of colossal disaster. John Bayliss and Kristen Stoddart, citing Sir Michael Quinlan, thinking about nuclear weapons. The ethos of the V-Force since its inception was a mixture of public disclosure and absolute secrecy. As the United Kingdom's independent national deterrent, it was necessary to demonstrate a capability whilst maintaining the mystery of how this would be achieved. Orders for the three bombers, the Valiant, Victor, and Vulcan, were public, and many overseas flights demonstrating a global reach were undertaken. As a deterrent, the type of targets in the Soviet Union were publicized, but the precise targets, the force routing, and the weapons effects were closely guarded secrets. Selected aircrew would assemble at their respective operational conversion units, usually two crews at a time, and be trained to fly their respective aircraft. Once the crew joined their assigned squadron, they would undertake various checks, but most importantly, they would undergo a period of intense study. This would be on an individual crew basis, with no discussion with other crews. they would need to study the Bomber Command War Standard Operations Procedures, the detailed target folders for their assigned targets, and pass verbal tests on each target by wing specialists before being declared combat ready. On the squadron, attack profiles could be discussed and practiced, but no crew had knowledge of the routing of any other crew. For the ground crews, they would prepare the aircraft for routine training flights, be deployed on occasion to dispersal airfields, and, for a few, get to fly on overseas trips. Beyond this, ground crews were as much in the dark as the air crews. Secrecy extended not just between air crew and ground crew, but to families as well. Dr. Tony Redding has drawn aside this veil of secrecy. Others have published works that give some insight into this secret world, but Tony Redding's work on the nuclear deterrent is unique, as he has skillfully combined meticulous research on higher command policy and studies by the Bomber Command Operational Research Branch with first-hand accounts from many aircrews and supporting ground crew who flew or worked on the aircraft. He has examined the viability of the deterrent, from the 4-minute warning and the ability to survive a preemptive Soviet strike to the crew's ability to reach their targets. Personal tales reveal thoughts about what the crews were told and their faith in their mission and its chances of success should the unthinkable happen. This work should appeal to both academics and a general readership, especially to aircrews, ground crew, families, and indeed anyone interested in this tense period of the Cold War. Roy Brocklebank, Vulcan Nav/Radar, Wing Targeting Officer, RAF Waddington. 1. Britain's Airborne Deterrent. We intend as soon as possible to build up a force of modern bombers capable of using the atomic weapon to the fullest effect. A strong and efficient force of medium bombers is of the greatest importance. Command 9075, Statement on Defence, February 1954. The Obvious Counter. On the 10th of August 1945, the day after the plutonium bomb exploded over Nagasaki, British Prime Minister Clement Attlee established Gen 75, a cabinet committee charged with establishing Britain as a nuclear power. The world had changed. The obvious counter to an atomic bomb on London was an atomic bomb on the enemy capital. The race to create a credible British nuclear deterrent was underway, with no question over the means of delivery. Nazi Germany's V-2 rocket signposted the future, but Britain remained wedded to the strategic bomber. The national interest required a nuclear weapon system ready by the second half of the 1950s. The bomber was the UK's fastest route to an operational deterrent. There was a belief that missile technologies would not mature until the V-Force had been in service for some time. Yet, by the time this bomber fleet deployed in strength, ballistic missiles had taken centre stage. During 1946, Air Staff Operational Requirement OR.229, Specification B.35/46, called for a four-engined bomber able to carry a 10,000-pound bomb at 500 knots at 55,000 feet. Three types emerged. The advanced Vulcan and Victor, responses to B.35/46, and the more conventional Valiant, an interim type, a response to a separate operational requirement, OR.231. The decision to build all three, creating the V-Force, or more formally, the Medium Bomber Force, MBF, echoed the wartime decision to build the Stirling, Halifax and Lancaster four-engined bombers. During 1953, Air Chief Marshal Sir Ronald Ivelore Chapman, Vice Chief of the Air Staff, VCAS, minuted the Secretary of State for Air, stressing MBF significance and adding, For deterrence, the biggest force we can afford is the least we should provide. Later, he added, one thing that is clear is the overriding importance of the MBF. In peace, it is the force which can provide the necessary power behind our voice in international affairs, and in war, it is the one force with which we could strike a worthwhile blow against our enemies. What would that blow consist of? At the time, the priority was to reach out and destroy Soviet nuclear forces capable of striking the UK. A draft paper of 7th of July 1955 identified 103 Soviet bomber bases, 750 to 1,500 nautical miles from the UK, and posing a threat to Britain. This also referred to a 31st of May 1955 Bomber Command Directive, underlining the need to destroy the enemy's will to continue the war by attacking population centres. 72 Soviet cities were considered as targets, 37 within 1,500 nautical miles of the UK, and 35 between 1,500 and 2,000 nautical miles. The significance of a mix of both counterforce, military, and countervalue, city, targets, was recognized from the first. Eventually, this was reflected in the MBF's two target lists. Plan A, the Single Integrated Operations Plan, or SIOP, the military targets making up NATO's wartime fighting program, and Plan B, the National Target List, which maximized the retaliatory threat in the unilateral context by focusing on the biggest Soviet cities. There was deterrent value in having two plans, as it complicated the enemy's assessment task. Given Britain's parlous post-war condition and the immense cost of building a British bomb and delivery system, the Air Ministry explored unconventional, lower-cost alternatives. One, Blue Moon, was a crewless, expendable bomber, capable of reaching Moscow. Blue Moon waned due to the lack of a reliable guidance system. In the final analysis, the need for a workable deterrent was too important for radical experimentation. Many futuristic projects existed on paper, but Bomber Command's daily reality at this time was more akin to World War II. The early 1950s strategic bombing force consisted of Avro Lincolns, a Lancaster derivative unable to attack Soviet targets. Nevertheless, operational requirements for the new jet bombers were extremely demanding and, if met, would allow the RAF to leapfrog an entire generation of strategic aircraft. This would take time. Meanwhile, as a stopgap, Bomber Command's heavy squadrons acquired American B-29s, known in the RAF service as the Washington. By mid-1952, Bomber Command had over 80 B-29s. There had been some debate as to whether the Washingtons carried atomic weapons. They did not. The USAF historian William W. Suit has pointed out that nuclear-armed Washingtons would have violated the provisions of the U.S. Atomic Energy Act, 1946. At the same time, the development of a British nuclear weapon and the existence of the potential means of delivering it sent a powerful signal into the world community. Simultaneously, Britain's twin-jet nuclear-capable Canberra pointed the way to the future. This light bomber, arising from specifications including B.3/45, entered service in 1951. The New Bombers. At the strategic level, the British felt it unwise to rely entirely on American weapons and aircraft. Three tenders for the new bombers were progressed, and work began under a haze of over-optimistic forecasts and expectations. Tony Blackman commented, although the new operational requirement for what was to become the V bombers, conceived in 1947, was clearly going to push the engineering of the day to its limits, the intention was to get the aircraft into service by 1951, which in itself demonstrates how little idea the air staff had of the task they had laid before the various manufacturers. In January 1948, Avro received clearance to proceed with Vulcan prototypes, known as Avro 698. This bomber first flew on the 30th of August 1952. A few weeks previously, Avro had received a contract for 25 production aircraft, soon followed by a second order for 37. The RAF took delivery of its first Vulcan on the 20th of July 1956. Handley Page's HP-80 became the Victor, which first flew on the 24th of December 1952. An initial order for 25 had been placed that June. The first Victor arrived at 232 Operational Conversion Unit, OCU, RAF Gaydon, on the 28th of November 1957. The type entered service in 1958. A total of 217 production Vulcans and Victors were built over a 10-year period. The final V-bomber built, Vulcan B.2 XM-657, was delivered in January 1965. The interim Vickers Valiant first flew on the 18th of May 1951. A parallel insurance type, the Short Sperrin, did not enter production. The Valiant was the first of the three V-bombers to become operational, February 1955, and saw action in the conventional bombing role during the October/November 1956 Suez conflict, Operation Musketeer. As some Valiants were not fully fitted with the new navigation and bombing system, NBS, the RAF resorted to World War II-style target marking. It was in 1956 that SA-1 surface-to-air missiles, SAMs, first deployed around Moscow. The more capable SA-2 then appeared. By 1964, there were some 600 SA-2 sites. Growing Soviet defensive and offensive capabilities were a major challenge to the RAF's new bombers. The golden age of the V-Force in its original high-altitude strategic bombing role would be very short. This era came to an abrupt end when a Soviet SA-2 guideline SAM brought down Gary Power's U-2 from a height of around 70,000 feet on the 1st of May 1960. Former Vulcan nav/radar Roy Brocklebank has a particular view on this event. "I think too much is made of the single U-2 shoot-down at 70,000 feet compared with a high-flying bomber at 56,000 feet. The environment in which the U-2 was shot down was benign. There were no electronic countermeasures, ECM. There were no other penetrating targets. There were no nuclear explosions. The U-2 made considerable ingress into Russian airspace before a successful engagement. Its speed was considerably less than that of a V-bomber, even a Valiant. Nevertheless, while the Russians may have struggled to destroy the U-2, in the final analysis, they did succeed." Credibility. V-Force operational effectiveness was more than a simple function of force size. RAF Air Historical Branch researcher Clive Richards identified three factors underpinning MBF credibility: the ability to disperse and protect the bomber force in time of war, the development of robust transition to war procedures, and the maintenance of a proportion of bomber command at a high state of peacetime readiness, capable of retaliating in the event of a surprise preemptive attack. Credibility demanded round-the-clock, all-weather capability. As Dr. Les Ruskell, a former head of the Operational Analysis Cell at UK Joint Permanent Headquarters, Northwood, points out, "The credibility of the deterrent depends not just on the ability to survive to launch and to reach the target, but also to sustain operations even in bad weather." The Royal Aircraft Establishment, RAE, at Farnborough, contributed much to V-Force all-weather capability and other factors underpinning operational success, including bomb ballistics. The major issue surrounding manned bomber delivery of the deterrent was exposure to destruction on the ground. The true measure of V-Force credibility was not its paper strength, but rather the proportion of the force that would survive preemptive attack. The survivors would then run the gauntlet of the Soviet coastal defense belt, fighter, SAM, and gun area defenses, and finally point defenses concentrated around targets. Furthermore, each British bomber carrying a free-fall weapon would be exposed, potentially, to at least two nuclear bursts, one over its home airfield, and subsequently the detonation of its own weapon over the target. Whilst the V-bombers would almost certainly arrive after an opening missile exchange, they would be the first strategic bombers attempting penetration. A special place in Western defense. A deterrent consisting of a small force of subsonic bombers had obvious operational drawbacks, but the MBF occupied a special place in Western defense, as explained by Bayliss and Stoddart. Britain, as a second center of nuclear decision-making, had significance because it complicated the deterrent calculations of the Soviet Union, who had to take heed of the decision-making of a separate government to the United States. This was seen to guard against any decline in the US nuclear guarantee. Britain could act independently of the US should the situation demand it, with French withdrawal from the military structure of NATO in 1966, British nuclear weapons came to be viewed as being held in trust for Europe, just in case the Soviet Union perceived that the US might be reluctant to defend Europe. The emerging V-Force developed a capacity to go to war in two contexts: as part of the NATO warfighting program, or in a unilateral UK retaliatory strike. The National Plan. World War II's legacy. The British airborne deterrent emerged in a logical way. Firstly, there was a strong national affiliation to the strategic bomber. In the recent past, Britain had made a major contribution to the destruction of Nazi Germany through the strategic bombing of cities and other targets. The campaign was pursued in a highly cost-effective manner, as outlined in 1947 by Marshal of the Royal Air Force Lord Tedder when delivering the Lees Knowles Lectures at Cambridge. Over 30 years later, Air Vice Marshal Stuart Mennall commented, "He pointed out that at the peak of the war, bomber operations took approximately 12% of the direct war effort and averaged, over the whole war, only 7%. In addition to the devastating effects the bomber offensive had on Germany's war-making capacity, contributing more than any other single factor to their inability to continue the war, Tedder emphasized that the battle for air superiority over Europe, prior to the landing of Allied forces on the Normandy beaches, was achieved not by fighters, but by bombers." This last observation might be contested by the pilots of P-51 Mustang long-range escort fighters, but it must be true that the huge American formations bombing Germany by day forced the Luftwaffe to commit its dwindling fighter resources, regardless of losses. Tedder had said, "I am utterly convinced that the outstanding and vital lesson of this last war is that air power is the dominant factor in this modern world, and that, though the methods of exercising it will change, it will remain the dominant factor so long as power determines the fate of nations." So it was to prove, and ballistic missiles, in particular the submarine-launched ballistic missiles, SLBM, became dominant. Tedder's words, however, were delivered at a time when Britain had an extraordinarily advanced and creative aircraft industry, well placed to provide advanced jet bombers to carry the British bomb. The Anglo-American relationship. Other factors surrounding the development of the British nuclear deterrent included the extraordinarily close wartime relationship between the RAF and what was then the USAAF, later the USAF. These ties were strong enough to survive a distinct chill on the political front in the immediate post-war years, when the United States was the sole possessor, albeit briefly, of nuclear weapons. Sir Frank Cooper, a wartime RAF pilot who joined the Air Ministry in 1948 and rose to become permanent Under Secretary of State for Defense by the mid-1970s, wrote of this period, "The United States adopted a firm policy that it would have a monopoly of nuclear weapons on behalf of the Allies. Strongly held American reservations about Britain becoming a nuclear power were to dog Anglo-American relations for some years to come. In Britain, there was a unity of purpose and determination to build an atomic energy plant with or without American assistance. The only issue, therefore, was whether the United States would help and so bring the date of acquisition forward. It was to be some long years before full cooperation was restored. Hence, Britain had to evolve its own nuclear policy, largely through the Royal Air Force. There is clear evidence that the Air Force wanted to enter the nuclear world in a practical sense as soon as possible, and I suggest that it played a major part in developing the theory of deterrence." The B-29s arrive in Britain. It wasn't long before USAF B-29s arrived in Britain. Over 2 days in mid-July 1948, at the invitation of PM Clement Attlee, 60 B-29s landed at British bases for what was first envisaged as a 30-day training deployment. There was no formal Anglo-American agreement, yet Scampton, Marham, Waddington and Lakenheath hosted the six USAF heavy bomber squadrons. Before these aircraft had actually reached England, their stay was extended to 60 days as part of the Western Allies' response to the Soviet ground blockade of West Berlin. 60 days then became 90. During November, the Air Ministry told Washington that long-term use of UK RAF bases by USAF aircraft was assumed. The two governments reached an agreement to this effect. It is easy to understand British eagerness to provide forward bases for American strategic bombers. This meant direct shelter under the American nuclear umbrella. The provision of B-29s for RAF squadrons could be regarded as a quid pro quo for use of UK air bases. It drew the two governments together at a time when the US desire for continued nuclear monopoly tended to push them apart in the political context. Naturally, the presence of thousands of American servicemen in Britain made it more difficult to isolate the USA from its European allies, and, of course, it was impossible to attack Britain without destroying American personnel and assets. During the first half of 1949, the USAF regularly rotated heavy bomber units to UK bases for 90-day tours. The aircraft were held on six-hour alert, but this was relaxed in May of that year when the Soviets lifted the Berlin blockade. In August 1949, the detonation of a Soviet atomic bomb signaled new realities. In the UK, the USAF relocated their bombers away from the British East Coast, eventually leading to the occupation of Brize Norton, Fairford, Upper Heyford, and Greenham Common. Then the outbreak of the Korean War in June 1950 led to a rapid expansion of USAF strength in the UK, facilitated by earlier decisions. During a September 1949 conference in Washington, it was agreed to open up 30 British bases to the USAF. The four main bomber bases, three air depots, and 23 other airfields for use by heavy and medium bombers, fighter escorts, reconnaissance aircraft, and tankers. By 1951, the USAF had two main elements in Britain: the B-29s of 7th Air Division, and the 3rd Air Force, responsible for tactical operations and logistics. The American presence continued to grow. By 1955, the USAF occupied around 80 UK installations, the heavy bomber units.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?